Well, hello and welcome to the unofficial Unreal Engine podcast, where we talk about all things Unreal Engine and also rooftop fire pits that close at 9 p.m. I'm your host, Alex Coulomb, and with me is my good friend, Bartosz. Say hello, Bartosz.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet everybody.
And as per usual, we will begin with our word association. We're here at Unreal Fest, by the way, a couple days early. Bartosz is coming in from Poland. I'm coming in from a crazy couple of days at MetaConnect over in the San Francisco Menlo Park area. We'll get into that, but we're first going to start with Bartosz and all the fun things happening here. Are you ready for some word association?
Yes, go ahead. Fire.
Home.
You need that? Stool.
Fresh air.
Work.
That's true.
Lots of passion.
Food.
Food?
Food.
Travel.
Yeah. Shrimp.
Travel.
Short distance.
Fortnite.
Fun.
Virtual production.
With new big time. I use what? My independence.
My love.
Unreal Engine.
Atlantics.
The thing that got me into that love.
All right. And Bartosz, how do you take your coffee if you drink coffee?
I drink coffee. How do I take my coffee? Usually it's a black coffee, sometimes with milk, espresso. I keep my coffee very Italian. I love the Italian lifestyle of the coffee. So not too many coffees a day, but at least two every day for the past. Since I remember when I was 16, drinking coffee. So I'm every day drinking coffee. I love coffee. We can talk coffee all day.
Well, for this particular trip, because you've come a long way to be here in Seattle, what has your coffee experience been like over the past couple of days?
It's been wild because it's been from the greatest coffee ever to probably the thing that I shouldn't put in my... because it's so bad. It's just the motel coffee that was that, right? Yeah, I was just like, I call it... It's called the coffee, it's piss coffee in Polish. It's a bit bad name.
Yeah, I'm always interested in this. This was a question that Jacob came up with, but I'm fascinated by it because I've never been much of a coffee drinker, and I always love hearing everyone else's habits. I usually will only have coffee if I explicitly know I'm in a place with excellent coffee, like Italy, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very interesting. Do you drink much tea or mostly coffee?
Tea, coffee.
All that good.
Yeah, all the good stuff.
Amazing. All right. Next question is, what is your favorite time of day? If you had to pick one.
My favorite time of day. I have to pick one, like a minute or a hour or...
Have you ever done that? Yeah, pick your favorite minute.
My favorite minute of the day. It's definitely the moment when I want to, right before I have my coffee, that I'm anticipating getting the coffee. And then I know that once I'm doing the coffee, that moment. And then when I'm having the coffee, that's already the past, which is the fun part. But it's right before that sweet spot.
I love that. I love that we're really turning this into a coffee episode.
Sorry.
That's great. And when's the last time you remember having like a big, proper, guttural laugh? Something that made you laugh really hard.
When was the last time I really, really deep laughed?
Yeah, it can be a movie, it can be a thing that happened with friends, it could be you saw someone slip on a banana peel,
mm-hmm.
Anything that made you laugh.
Hamsi today.
Well, the last time I really, really laughed is...
Of going back to sight.
That's a good one, yeah. That's a really good one because I don't really think about that much when you laugh. I try to laugh a lot, like smile to people and laugh, but I never think about like this is something that I've cracked, you know, really, really cracked up about and started laughing that much.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great question. Can I sit on? Oh, let's come back to that one.
Back to that one. That's great. All right. And now ready to introduce you properly. This is Bartosz Berlaski, everyone. Coming to us from Poland. Bartosz, why are you here in Seattle this week, today?
I'm here to do a talk, actually, at Seattle, at Unreal Fest. I'm excited. I'm a little bit nervous, but also anticipating this whole thing. And it's been a long way coming for me as an educator and Unreal artist.
And from Poland also.
Yeah, I'm from Poland.
How often have you been to the United States, and have you ever been to Seattle before?
I've never been to the United States as a grown person, because I was here when I was little, 4 or 5 years. My parents took me to Disneyland when we were traveling along Canada, but not when I was as an adult. So this is a first for me.
Wow. How were customs and just the whole process of getting here?
Oh, it was fun. Because the guy just asked me, what are you doing here? I'm like, well, we're coming to an epic event. And he's like, what's epic?
That's so epic.
What's so epic about it? I'm like, oh, it's epic, Unreal Engine. And I started like talking to him, like, do you know Fortnite? And he's like, move along. And,
yeah. Right.
And he asked me, do you do films or games? Something like that. Yes, films. And I said, yes, I do films.
Yeah, that makes sense. Great. Well, we're going to cover a bunch of stuff today, but let's start with a little bit of your backstory, Bartosz. Like, where did you come from? What were you like as a kid? What got you excited? And what are some of the steps along the way to get you here today, now?
Wow. All right. What got me excited about this was definitely my Nintendo. I started with the Nintendo. My parents got me a Nintendo, and that was the opening gateway for everything. And then it came along from there where, because I was a little bit, my family was a traveling family. We migrated from Canada to Egypt for 2 years. We lived in Egypt, and that's where I saw my first Macintosh. I broke it. And I just didn't boot up anymore. Imagine, like, and I didn't know how to fix it. And we had to take it back to the repair shop. It was one of the original, like, cool Macintoshes. And that's where I kind of experienced first the interface of a Word document that's, you know, with beautiful fonts.
Yeah.
And then I came back to the PC era when we moved back to Poland. And from there, it was just PCs. And I have a long history of just breaking computers and building up them myself. It's been a long way coming through. But the thing that really got me inspired, that got me into this, I got to say, is John Carmack work, Quake.
Mm-hmm.
I was inspired as a 13, 12-year-old trying to make a map in BSP. I don't know even what was that format, but it was like trying to make something out of, you know, wood sticks, and it was really, really hard to work in that program. But when I actually got through that and I published actually put out my first map that I could run through in Quake 1, yeah, it opened something in my mind. And that's still pursued until this day at Unreal Fest, Fortnite, and everything. That moment, right? And my mom came into my room and said, because I played a lot of computer games, and she said, She used to rush into my room and say, hey, you're playing computer games. And I was like, mom, wait, I'm going to be making these things. You know? And she really didn't believe me. But then after, when she saw that, hey, he's not only playing games, he's actually doing modding. Or she understood the difference between playing a game, like playing, and doing something with the game. Yeah. And that was where she kind of went, okay, it's your thing. And she just left me at it. I got a lot of screen time.
That's amazing. You'd say you had supportive parents.
In that sense, yeah, super supportive in that sense. They were amazing about me. They always provided me, get me like a computer, get me the first thing that got me into it. And a lot.
And what was it like? Let's just kind of keep stepping through it. What was it like to go from, you know, modding something, creating maps, to maybe making something more from scratch? And then how do we also get to that point where you tried Unreal Engine for the first time?
Well, that wasn't long, because after the modding, I kind of went into more business-like. Purely because of I just thought that that's a wise thing to do, to just go to business school and do an MBA, and that would be really, really good, and it will work in my career. And that was, well, you know, I'm not going to say that MBAs are great or not. It's just that it's not about the education that you get. It's more about the people that you meet during your education. And they really make that difference for me, at least. That's what happened, right? The question, what was the question? I'm trying to follow your question more.
I want to keep expanding. Like, I Marshall over here, who's not in camera frame, like, he's also someone who started with modding maps and like playing with some of that stuff. Oh no, now you have to sign a waiver. Marshall also came from that world of like modding maps. And I'm always interested when people go from that and like modifying something, editing something, to then starting more from scratch. And like whatever tools you were using to start more from scratch, what was that like?
That was virtual production for me. Mm-hmm. That opened that world. That was it. Because that I remember that it was modding. Well, this is fun. I'm never going to make a game. It takes like a team of hundreds of people to make a game. I'm not an engineer, not in that sense that I can program an engine that will do something that I want it to do. No way. But now, with the experience of working with virtual production, jumping into that, learning that those basics of just, you know, moving a camera around there, my first thing was to move a cube in Unreal with blueprints.
Right.
That was, and when that happened, a sequencer came out.
Yeah. Matinee, yeah.
Matinee. That was it was kind of the precursor of sequencer. And I remember figuring out Matinee or what it, well, that was, that Matinee, the name of it. And but just moving a cube in blueprints, and I was like, all right, this is it. I've opened the doors to everything. And then when you more start digging into it, you understand that it's not all about tech. It's more, there's a lot of art to it. There's a lot of color theory. There's just so much things that go into making something beautiful in a computer in general when you're trying to do something, that I've learned to step back more from the technology side and just look at from a different perspective.
That's really cool. And I guess it's worth asking, did it feel, once you started to get more holistically involved with all these different aspects, did it feel like, oh, this is overwhelming and there's so many things I need to learn how to do? Or did it still kind of feel like modding and creating, you know, edited levels?
Great question. That's both feelings. I felt terrified the more I learned, because I just knew that I know nothing the more I learned. It's like entering a forest and seeing more trees, and is that analogy. So it was scary, but the more I learned and the more I came back to it with my head down rather than my head up, in the sense where what I mean by head down is by being just humble to the engine that's giving me a lot of power and just possibility and everything. And then you're overusing that power, and then you're fighting with that engine instead of swimming with it.
Right.
I got out of that. Yeah, I had a lot of that. And that's one of my ways of teaching, that I try to get that across. Because when I see students, they want to jump in and throw everything. I want to do Niagara and that and then another and Niagara and everything and everything. And add so much things to one project that they get overwhelmed and they just move on to the next project. And it's, you know, and it, you have like this graveyard of epic projects that are in the market, in your library, that are really low, you know.
Yeah.
Right. So I try to discourage that, so people, students who learn Unreal Engine, get the most out of it with the fun things that it offers, which is sequencer for me, which is running around with a powerful plugin that's already provided by Epic, that gets a lot of things done for you, and just recording that into Take Recorder and then placing a camera. So, and that's the fun things, right? But I don't get, you, as you know, probably, it's hard to make a living out of fun things unless you're only teaching them, and in the sense where there won't be many companies paying for this kind of work, that I'll be running a metahuman around a parkour place, right?
As fun as it is.
As fun as it is, they wanted, you know, a stationary camera with a nice virtual production background. And that was their interest. And what I've learned also, in virtual production, at least, everybody wanted to move the cameras.
Right.
Why? Right? When the client arrived to the set, he was like, I like that, and that camera is not moving. And why are you like building this whole tech to move a camera? If I like that shot, and I'm good, and it cost me half as much, and that's kind of got me thinking, like, don't throw all your toys at everything, because people will get overwhelmed, or they will just back out of it completely and say, this is not for me.
I've had exactly the same problem, especially when it comes to things like virtual reality, where I get so excited about what you can do that it's very easy to leave all the normal people behind as you're running away. Like, we can do this and this and this and this and this. And they're like, maybe we just don't do that at all then. Yeah. What was it like? Tell me a little more about your first virtual production experiences and what it was like to get into that. Can you talk about like the project?
I'd love to. It was getting into agencies who back in the time were converting their crummy LED screens into virtual production sets and just calling them, hey, we're a virtual production company. And they had no idea about virtual production. And they kind of, it was interesting, an interesting time period because I back when virtual production really hit the masses, I was publishing a lot of videos about it and just talking about it and just showing people, hey, you can do this in your desktop computer with just a GPU and a capture card and some trackers. And that got me also really fascinated into this whole thing. And from there, it took me to, hey, can you show up at our studio and show us how this is run, how to do virtual production? So I show up at their studio and I see their equipment and I say, sorry, guys, well, you want to do virtual production at this level with toys that are for kids. Mm-hmm. And that was, I would get in trouble with DPs, with directors, or guys, because I would just bluntly say to them, like, you're not ready for this. You want the quality here that you see, like, on Epic's demos and everything, while you're throwing resources that are either one, overworked on real guy with everything happening to him, and everybody running up to the Unreal, server. While this poor Unreal soul is trying to put everything together and run everything at a decent frame rate.
Yeah. What year was this?
Oh, this was just when it happened. I think it was 4.27. It was right before COVID, Unreal 5 hit the market. So it was that transition period of everybody being, virtual production will be everywhere. Virtual production stages were popping up everywhere. It was insane. It was all over the world. And then, you know, everything passed and the technology stayed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and tell me more about what happened during the pandemic for you. Were you finding ways to work on site? Were you doing more things remote?
Yeah, it was usually showing up at sets with my PC.
Yeah.
That was more competent to run the show, which was my gaming PC, than their dedicated broadcast whatever they had. It was real because I just built a PC to play Fortnite at 4K,
right? And that was better than
What they were trying to pull off with all their really complicated resources and just, you know, SDI connections and everything. And
it just seemed like a wizard.
It seemed to them like they would show up and look at the computer and they were like, we need to buy better computers. I was like, yes. And then they would eventually go through that process. And now they're pretty much set up. It's now the pain points are gone, I would say. Now they're running the shows. Clients are showing up. They're tracking whatever. People have, they've toned down their experiences with the technology and they know what to expect from it now rather than go into it like this is going to be the best thing ever and everybody's going to have a blast.
Right. Yeah, I hear that completely. Wow. And you've gotten into teaching quite a bit, too. When did teaching in general start, and how did you get to the point of being involved with the fellowships and all that?
That was that transition period also from the virtual production side, where I was basically saying to the production teams that I was helping out on set to, hey, I'm going to just post a video, and you should follow my tutorial if you want to do this at a decent quality with me. And they would... Those tutorials posting on YouTube got me to the point that I just got some followers from it. And they really, it was weird because I was doing it because I was interested in it.
Right.
I really wanted to figure it out, not because somebody else was paying it for it. It was really weird. I was just, and then it came out to be that, hey, you actually figured out a pipeline that we can monetize in the studio pretty well.
Right.
And yeah, it was all based on, you know, Resolve talking to Unreal through capture cards so they could get a preview and just capture it, you know, already in 4K without going through the whole rendered pipeline, and the client was happy with the results. So that got me thinking, hey, I need to teach this rather than provide solutions, because what I've learned is that people are much smarter in companies in general than the educator is. What I mean by that is, if you go in gain guns and blazing at the educator and say, you can do this, and they will figure out, a company will look at that and they go, okay, that's really good, we'll just take that one thing and we'll monetize it. While an educator doesn't think that way, that much.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And in what format did your teaching start to happen? Was it at virtual production studios? Was it in the computer lab? Tell me more about that.
It was mostly around computer labs and virtual production stages. That's where the teaching happened.
And the students?
Oh, the students were usually the guys and girls working in at the LED. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, I've learned that in virtual production, there's a whole team who essentially moves the set to a different location and sets it up. And all that whole team, there's much more people involved in moving stuff to sets than to actually running the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to learn how they make and build the LED screen, right? And I would go up to the technicians and say, hey, can you say how you do these things? And you're like, they would either freeze up or say, oh, I'm under an NDA, and I couldn't get it, across, because it was just like, I would either get kicked out of sometimes, virtual production client run shows, because they didn't like the over educational aspect that they didn't need, maybe. So I would, but that's the way I am. I'm really open. I don't feel that hiding knowledge is beneficial to anybody in the sense, or monetizing it behind their back or something like that. I'd rather to be an open discussion, and then we come up with the best solution and work with fun people. So I've always navigated that way with being open. And it's, some people told me, hey, it won't be the best thing ever for your as a career to be like always open for everything. Sometimes it's good to keep some things for yourself.
Yeah.
Yes. But then in the end, I'm here, right? They're not. And that's why I keep on sharing and being the same way, right? And just doing it as much as I can.
Yeah, that's amazing. You did the storytelling fellowship with our previous guest, Arturo Brena. By the way, shout out to Arturo. Shortly after our episode last week, their Horde UEFN game skyrocketed on the charts. They became an epic pick. Just a nice little news update. As we were speculating last week, could this go anywhere? And now it's like to the moon. And we might even see Arturo in the next couple of days here at Unreal Fest. But tell me a little bit about what it was like being more on the student side of that particular fellowship for storytelling, and then what it was also like to then become more of a teacher for the fellowship the next.
I'll try to. I can definitely say that from the aspect from the student that's doing it as the first time, because I think Escape Studios was all involved there as a studio, which was really cool, because we got the best guys from the ad agency and everything talking about storytelling, and they make money on this. So we were like, wow, this is really cool. And they had their classes. The problem back then on the storytelling fellowship was some people still had their classes and lectures made in 4.27, 4.26, while everybody wanted to work on 5. Mm-hmm. And they were like, why are we having classes on 4.27 interface if I'm not even there? And it was very confusing back then. But we pushed through it. I worked in 5.01 early access, mm-hmm. barely worked. But we were so excited that we had Nanite and we wanted to just play around with the tech. And just from the perspective as a fellow, I remember now I think fellowships are very, they've changed in the sense where they're more structured and organized. Well, the first one was, hey, this is your group. you should form a Discord, and whatever you do, just try to do something.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. It was like, just try to do something. And it was like the hope was to do something. And now it's more like, you know, organized and structured.
Was there, I'm comparing it to the fellowship that I just got to TA, were there a lot of lectures, special guests, mentoring? What did that look like?
Yes, that was always there. That was there. And that was, I'm super grateful that Epic does that. That's the best part of it. The special guests, the guys from Epic doing the talk, right? Just showing their, you know, the back end of stuff, or just telling or giving snippets that this is coming in the next version. That was amazing, right? So that they always had that. Were there any problems? I think it was this sheer amount of information blasted at you and what time. And it doesn't matter if it was world building, doesn't matter if it was story building or animation. There's just so much information that gets thrown at you. I can imagine that the game, and when we heard that the fellowship is doing, that Epic is doing a game fellowship, we're like, good luck. We're like, let me know, because we know how much stuff happens around just sequencer, which is just probably a part of a game. Or, right, just making an animation, the cinematic itself, caused so much stress for some people to try to get it in time. So I can imagine for you running the game fellowship, that was a challenge for you to get that.
Yeah.
Was it a bug fighting?
It is.
Or was it more like sailing through it?
For a lot of people, for the games fellowship, it was the first game they'd ever made. We had a few different kinds of people. It was either they'd never made a game before, but they knew something about Unreal Engine, or they knew something about Unreal Engine, they had made games in other engines before, like Unity or Godot or CryEngine or whatever, and they were trying to bring some of those skills over to Unreal. Or they had worked on games, sometimes at very big studios, but in a very narrow capacity. They're like, you know, a 3D modeler or an art director, and now they're trying to learn more of these other parts of it. So the common problem for everyone was scope creep. It was this idea of like, you know, you only have a few weeks, but people wanted to have these really big, ambitious games. And just helping everyone kind of clamp down to like, those ambitions are great. I hope that all happens. But let's start with kind of the core fundamental, like, if you could only do one thing, you know, how do we make sure that that part gets done?
How did you distill that between the students, if I may ask?
Yeah, everyone was given was asked to create a game design document. So something that really showed what their plan was and like how they planned.
That was the first week, right?
Yeah, like first day, like right away, tried to have that. And I think what a lot of the students, we talked about this in our finale a couple episodes ago, but what a lot of the students, I think, weren't prepared for was so much of the day actually ended up being scheduled. So there wasn't as much developer time, like there wasn't as much time to just sit down and do things,
right?
Because every morning there was a special guest, and then there was a lab, and then there was a, you know, a thing that would happen in the afternoon, and then there's a evening speaker, and then we'd have a class on like, let's learn how to do runtime animation blueprints. And so much of it was just this, to use Sean Spitzer's term, who's also behind us somewhere, Sean was like, it's a fire hose of information. I was like, yes, absolutely. So you're just trying to drink what you can, but it was important to make sure everyone knew, like, you don't need to use all of this. Like, don't try to use everything you're learning. Grab the things out of the fire hose. Now I'm pretending there's like candy and other things coming out of the fire hose. Like, grab your favorite candy corn flavors or whatever, and try to just go with that, because obviously the games that end up being the most successful are the ones that latch on to a really fun fundamental idea. And once you get that core thing built out, like we had Hone on our final podcast, and he had this fundamental idea of like a car racing game where there's dinosaurs and the dinosaurs are standing on the cars while they're driving.
It sounded like a pitch you would do, like, you know, to a friend walking through a bar, right? And he made that game. That's amazing. That's amazing, right? That it sounds like a ridiculous pitch, and the game exists.
Yeah, and like the fundamental thing was like he could start from, you know, some of the car driving templates Epic provides, and you just had to figure out a good way to attach, you know, a T-Rex to the top. And then there was other things that could come later, like certain kinds of animations and ways for the dinosaurs to do battle and for there to be more dinosaurs. But there was like a seed there where it's like, even if all it is a normal car racing game with dinosaurs on the roof, like that's already a cool thing. And another quick update to a previous guest, congratulations to Hone, who's about to release his game for free on the Epic Game Store, so keep an eye out for that as well.
It's free, right?
Yeah, it's going to be free. I don't think it's out yet, but yeah, so we'll put the link to that in the show notes. So
definitely.
Try it out. Yeah,
I want to check it out. Does it run well?
I played the prototype yet during the fellowship, which ran fine on my RTX 4090 computer. I don't know what additional optimizations you might have done to make it run on a smaller computer.
Right. That's awesome. Well, I can't wait to play the games on cabinets. I've heard that there'd be like stuff and...
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about here at Unreal Fest. So one cool thing from the Games Fellowship, as Bartosz was just alluding to, is all the games that were made during the Unreal Games Fellowship over the summer are going to be not only at Unreal Fest, but like in retro arcade style cabinets with buttons and joysticks. Everyone had to build their games specifically accounting for this kind of enhanced input method. And I think that's going to be so fun to try them out in that capacity compared to just a keyboard and mouse or an Xbox controller.
Yes, I agree, because it's more of a visceral feeling. It's like, it's Mortal Kombat. They invented it, right? Did they invent it?
Oh, I don't know.
It was a Pac-Man. No, but just the arcade machine in general. It is. Of course, not invented it, but brought it to the main kind of arcade machines, right? Yeah.
I know when my dad was a kid, like, he spent so many quarters on Pac-Man. Like, that, it was just an incredibly addictive game. And one of the first ones that really, and speaking of, like, finding a seed of something unique, it's like he became really fascinated by the idea that Pac-Man was about running away in many cases. Like, you're not always attacking. It's like hiding. Right. We just saw a bunch of announcements today at the Tokyo Game Show about Hideo Kojima. And I was thinking about when Metal Gear Solid first came out in 1987, the year of my birth. It was a very interesting game because it wasn't about having these big shootouts. It was more of a hide-and-seek game and figuring out within the limitations of what an MSX console could render then. It's like, well, rather than having 50 bad guys, like, what if there's only a couple bad guys? But a lot of the thrill comes in hiding. So anytime anyone's finding those little seeds of, like, here's a little unique spin on something, that's where things get really interesting.
Wow. That's a lot of information. Alex, you talk really fast.
I do talk really fast.
But that's good. I like that stimulus because I process a little bit slower. But I like to talk with people who talk really fast and try to catch up with them. But it's really cool.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever expressed this, at least on the podcast, but my brain is wired in such a way where, to me, everyone around me, it always feels to me like everyone is talking too slow. And so when I listen to a podcast, when I watch a YouTube video, when I watch Unreal Fest talks, I play everything back at 2x speed. Because for whatever reason, that feels like a more natural way to engage with everything to me. And I apologize to everyone, of course, who's like, Alex, you talk way too fast. My response of which is usually like, if you're watching one of my videos, turn down the speed, make it 0.5x speed.
That makes total sense now. No, really, that makes it. But it's interesting because you can talk slower and then on 2x, you sound really competent.
Yeah, you do sound competent. And for the I Wish I Learned This Sooner talk over at Unreal Fest Prague, sometimes you're also just working within a time constraint, like Marshall over here and a bunch of the AgileLens team members. We put together all this content for this talk, and it was like, there's no way this is going to fit into an hour. So then if you're an educator like Bartosz and I are, and you're trying to get as much information out to everyone as possible, like, you don't want to overwhelm people. But like, when I knew I only had 1 hour to talk, it was like, well, maybe I can get an hour and a half worth of content in there. It's just going to be a little bit compressed. And then you hope that when I go over something way too fast, people will be able to like slow it down or Google more information about it. So you try to find those ways to like at least make sure people are aware of something, like, you know, the tape recorder is a great example. Like, a lot of people don't even know that's there and it's so powerful. So like, you know, I could do 10 minutes breaking down all the different aspects of that. And here's how to record your gameplay and edit it afterwards. And here's how to do camera moves. Or you just give them like the slightest hint that this is a thing that exists. And then you hope that you're exciting their curiosity, and then they'll go find the deeper dives into that one thing.
So how do you cut out your material? Because I have a really hard time with that. Like, because I put too much, 100% of material. And when I did my dry run, what I've learned is don't do too much.
Yeah.
It's sometimes better to do even 20 or 30%.
Yeah.
That's more, you know, to point than 100% of everything. enough. Like, how do you decide which sections to cut out on your topics, or because that's really hard for me.
Yeah.
I hate doing it live because that's where it gets really icky, right? It's better to have it planned out that I can go to this point, and this is, if I go over, that's added bonus.
Yeah, it's a great question. And certainly what you just said at the end there, that's key. It's like you want to reserve a lot of things where it's like, this is bonus. If we don't get to this, it's no problem at all. If we do, it's great. When you're giving a talk and it's more of a lecture format, you, of course, have a lot more control over how that time is going to be spent, and you can rehearse and do dry runs and fine. Now, I'm not giving any lectured, recorded talks at Unreal Fest. Bartosz isn't either. All of our talks at Unreal Fest here in Seattle are these live learning labs, and those are much more challenging because people can raise their hand and ask questions at any point, and you don't want to ignore them, even if you're like, oh, we got to move. Like, we only have so much time. Like, I ran into a problem last year at Unreal Fest in New Orleans. I was doing a diving deep with MetaHuman Animator class.
Right.
And I said, this is an intermediate class. Like, I assumed everyone in the class had used MetaHuman Creator. Like, I wanted to go further into the weeds with this stuff. But I had people in the class where I'd be like, okay, everyone, open up this map. And they'd be like, how do you open a map? And you're like, okay, well, it's like, you don't want to ignore them, but also it's like, this is an intermediate class. Like, you, so that's a really tricky balance, is finding a way to move things along. I will say one of the easiest things I go to is the slides. I will very quickly abandon slides, and I'll try to make sure they're available, use QR codes or whatever. So it's like, look, there's a lot of reference material in these slides. We're one of the labs we're teaching this year is about going from Unity to Unreal. And so we have a bunch of slides. There's like, here's a bunch of terms from Unity, and here's the equivalent of those terms in Unreal. And like, that could be like 5 minutes of discussion in the live lab. Or if we need to cut time, which we almost definitely do, we'll say like, we got some great slides here that go over a bunch of terms, review them at your leisure, but like, we want to spend as much time actively in the engine as possible. So I do find if I cut out anything, especially for a live lab, that is more lectury and that I think that they can look at on their own, you know, with those PDFs later on, then those are the first things that I'll cut. And then I will often try to think about if there's a simpler way to do a more complicated thing. So like, it's tough to be in a beginner's mindset. Like Whit Sellers, who's going to be teaching this Unity course with me, like he's very new to Unreal Engine. And so he's actually a great person to be teaching this course because he is still very fresh with like, what are the hiccups and what are the hurdles that are hard to get over? And I'm kind of an old man in this now. So like, sometimes I forget like how tricky it was to use Sequencer for the first time or whatever, and some of the things that are easy mistakes to make. And so trying to get in that mindset, that really helps, where you're like, okay, what are people going to stumble over? And can we either do something simpler, or in some cases, intentionally teaching some of the places where things break down or don't work, and making that part of the lecture as well. So rather than people raising their hand and saying, oh, this part isn't working, you're like teaching them like, this won't work. This is something you probably think is obvious to do. It's wrong. Here's why. And kind of streamlining some of that helps. What are some of the tips you do?
Well, that's really great tips, by the way. The golden nuggets. No, really, really, because it's a whole art of teaching. And I'm learning this right now by doing the dry runs. I did some fellowship support. And what I'm learning is that also don't overwhelm, right? People will back down from that. And just cutting material is really, really tough, because I feel that I need to cover this while, but do I, and like you said, if the first thing to skip that I'll cut out is slides, right? I'd rather jump in the live demo, break it, right? Show that it breaks and be cool about it. That's my heart. That's the heart. That's what thing that I struggle with. Once things break and I'm not prepared that it should be doing, like, I did it 50 times and then the 51st time, Unreal decides not to do it. And that's where I kind of panic when I've practiced something really, really hard and then it just doesn't work. And that, I think it's a really good skill to have as an educator, to be able to navigate that and just say, hey, this is part of this and this just happens, and you're kind of bringing people in that you're part of this, you're in control, rather than that thing being in control of you, right? So, and I'm still learning that. I think it comes with years and years of experience of teaching.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how closely you follow the VR scene, but do you know about any of the stuff that happened a few days ago at MetaConnect?
I follow the VR scene. I was strapping headsets, you know, DK1s to my backpack and running around in the city with GoPros here. So I've did my fair share of hype over VR. It would be, well, that was 2014, 2015, and now we're 10 years later. Can you tell me, Alex, what, because you've been there, what is it? What's the deal? What can you share with us on the podcast?
Yeah.
I'm going to say, I'm excited because you're dealing with technology that's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, you're making me think about what just happened over the past couple of days in MetaConnect, because they did a lot of live demos, and I appreciated that so much. Like, the keynote for MetaConnect was Mark Zuckerberg and Boz and all these guys there, not just talking about the roadmap and the things they want to do, or like, to, you know, it drives me crazy watching Apple these days at like WWDC and all that, where nothing's live. It's all pre-recorded, it's all canned, and they might be showing really cool features, but it's like, you're like, I don't know, was this all done in After Effects?
It's good virtual production.
Yeah, it's great virtual production. Yeah, all the stuff where they like swoop around the sky and fly in, and now Tim Cook is there. Like, cool, man.
Yeah.
But there's so much fun, especially for someone who loves live theater. Like, you want that tightrope act where something can go wrong. And at MetaConnect, a couple of the live demonstrations went wrong. And was my reaction, oh no, VR sucks, this is all broken, blah, blah, blah. It was, no, this is really cool. And I love seeing some of those places where there are hiccups. And the way they played it off was really good, too. Like, I thought Mark Zuckerberg, who, you know, for all his faults, I have not a lot of love for the guy, but I thought he came off incredibly human as he and the other presenters stumbled over some of the issues that were happening and still got the point across and made it work and found ways to improvise. It was really cool. And, you know, I'm at a point in the XR industry where I've kind of hit my limit for how excited I can be about specifically about the VR headset. So like the Quest 3S, that was the big product announcement. That's coming out in a month. You know, we pre-ordered one. We're going to have one for our office just to be able to show people and talk about it. But it's like the big innovation is we brought down the cost of the Quest 3 by $100 by using cheaper lenses and a couple other things. And it's like, cool, great, fantastic. But that's nowhere near the leap from, like, you know, the DK1 to the DK2, where it went from the 3-DOF headset to a 6-DOF headset and stuff like
that. Yes, that's where educators, like, wow, we can move around, we can walk around the room. We were stuck in front of a desktop before and we couldn't move, like.
Yeah, and so I've been getting a little bit jaded about that direction. And yet, Bartosz, something happened to me that completely reawakened my excitement about the XR industry. Can you guess what that might have been?
I can get a wild guess. It's something to do with glasses that you put on your face.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. So to set up the context for this a little bit, about a month ago, I was really lamenting, thinking about not only my own direction of feeling a little bit jaded about traditional VR headsets, but also how I'd also kind of hit the limit with the people who I was trying to convince to get excited about XR. This is both friends and people in the architecture industry and theater industry, where, like, I didn't think, you know, from Quest 1 to Quest 2, maybe, like, I got some more people excited. Quest 2 to Quest 3, fewer. And I was thinking, like, there was no one who isn't excited about VR right now, where the leap from Quest 3 to Quest 3S is going to make them excited.
I mean, how many people did you put headsets on? Because I think a lot.
Yeah, no, not even exaggerating, probably at least 1,500 people.
I'll be about 200 because I did like two or three events with the DK2. It was like a whole line of people lined up for a DK2.
Yeah.
It was amazing and insane. I don't know why I like showing people new technology.
Yeah.
I like showing people a 3D printer and they see it for the first time. DK2, right? So this, right, on the glasses thing, why do you think this is something that we should be, why is this the thing that we should be excited about?
What? Oh, the glasses, yeah.
Why is that something that changed your, that, okay, VR is fine, like, people hair get messed up, stuff.
we've got my makeup.
Yeah, why would I want this red thing on my face? I don't want to be blocked out from the world, you know. It's a lot of things VR that takes away from, well, this is something different. Do you know what? Is it going to be named?
Right. Well, yeah, to roll some of that out, like, there are so many direct negatives about wearing a VR headset. Everyone's afraid, you know, people are laughing at me. I'm messing up my hair. I'm messing up my makeup. And there's a lot of hurdles to overcome for VR to be worth it for someone. Now, I've been lucky to be working in a lot of enterprise spaces where, like, of course, for an architect who's trying to communicate a design idea to clients, you know, imagine trying to describe what the lobby we're in for the Hyatt Regency in Seattle, describing what this would look like, or trying to make people understand it with flat plans or flat sections or even flat renders, what this is like, compared to just putting on the headset. And it's like, now you understand the scale of the space and like, oh my goodness, what a beautiful, you know, ceiling height, which is so different from just saying the numbers. If you say this is a 70-foot high ceiling, it feels a little bit too abstract. So on the enterprise side, plenty of opportunities for VR to make sense. So I not only got to see the keynote with the Orion glasses, I also got to try them. And I didn't realize how exclusive this is going to be to actually get to try them out. And I had a lot of skepticism after seeing the demo. I wondered like how much of it was kind of marketing talk, even though there were live demos, great live demos. But I got to be whisked away right after the keynote to be the first person to actually try the Orion glasses myself. And the short version, Bartosz, is that this made me feel like the DK1 again. This made me feel like it's not just the demo.
DK1 or DK2?
Well, even the DK1.
Okay, just like for the first thing.
Yeah. Both of those were meaningful to me because the DK1 was the first time where I got a sense of like, oh, scale. Like I can show people architecture designs and they're going to get the scale. And then the DK2 was a large jump and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But getting a sense not only of like, these glasses are already doing an amazing thing I didn't know was possible, but now understanding the trajectory and this other product line, this other path that by its nature is quite different from the Quest path. You know, the Orion AR glasses direction, it's almost more of an evolution of the Ray-Bans. Marshall, can I have your Ray-Bans for a second? So this is a product that Meta has right now.
Oh, wait, is that it?
Yeah.
I haven't actually seen these live.
Yeah, so these don't have any screens. There's nothing visual, but there are cameras here, and there's audio, so you can hear things, and there's AI capabilities in this. Like, we're getting to that point where this is kind of becoming a second set of eyes for you, and you can walk around, and you can say, oh, you know, what's on my table? Like, what do I need to buy for groceries? What can I cook with the food in front of me? What's this guy's name again? I know I've seen him before. Right. And, you know, not all of that works yet, but we're getting to that point where you have this kind of computer vision assistant that is helping you understand the world better. So the glasses, the Orion glasses, are this kind of form factor. It's not a big, bulky VR headset that, you know, blocks out your eyes and makes it weird to have a conversation. It's this form factor where you're able to have a fairly normal conversation.
Right.
And yet it has all these capabilities of showing you AR content and stuff around you. Nice music, Marshall. I can hear his music. Yeah, it's great. It's a good beat. But having this form factor where I can still make eye contact with someone, have a normal conversation, but I can start to have this other information around me. And I, you know, I could be playing a game. I could be getting practical information. But it's a spatial computing device that understands the environment around me and is doing a lot of the same things and has a lot of the same capabilities as VR devices without messing on my hair, messing on my makeup, being too heavy, hurting my neck. You know, the Orion glasses are 100 grams, not much heavier than these. And they did a thing. It was the perfect time for me to see these glasses because a month before, I was speculating or I was thinking about how much of a dead end the Quest direction was for so many of the people I knew.
Right.
Stop listening to the music. Thank you, Marshall. No, it's okay.
That's cool.
It was making me want to dance too much. We'll find a nightclub later. But I was thinking about what a dead end the Quest direction was for so many people I knew and was getting to a point where like I was trying to imagine like what would it take to bring more people to the XR ecosystem. And I thought, okay, it needs to be incredibly comfortable, incredibly light. It needs to be wireless. And we need to find a way to like get less of the memory and CPU and all that from the headset, put that somewhere else. And I was imagining like, what if there was like, you know, a little puck like the Magic Leap or like some kind of separate PC and like that has all the compute and that's wirelessly streaming to the device. Like, couldn't that help make the device lighter? And this compute thing could get really big and really heavy and have more and more power. And I was thinking like, if that all just worked out of the box, because the other thing that turns people off from VR is the associations with gaming and some of the tech. You need to be like to get Steam VR to work and update drivers and deal with like registry edits and all that. Like, that's not the kind of thing my grandmother is going to do. But I was trying to imagine a device where it all just works. You just put on a headset and all just works. So I was speculating about this and I got really sad because so many of the responses to this Twitter and LinkedIn post I had was like, well, what you're describing is impossible. Like, the laws of physics won't allow for this. Like, you can't have all this.
Take years.
Yeah, you know, it's just like, well, they're like, you can't have this in a glasses form factor. Like, you know, they're like, you can't really get a Quest headset that much tinier and make it more comfortable, because even if you take out all the gaming and all that, like just understanding movement and motion and sixth off and all that, like a lot of that tech has to be there. So I was kind of at a point where like, okay, it doesn't exist. And then less than a month later, I'm putting on these Orion glasses and there's sixth off content all around me and it's comfortable. It never got hot. It never got uncomfortable. It just worked in this way that I was like, you can't do this. So that gave me such a renewed hope for like what's possible. And, you know, it's probably going to be a few years before this is actually available as a consumer device. I hope Meta gives us a dev kit, you know, that we can start to play with. We love dev kits to just try to figure out how to create content for this. But it's literally the most excited I've been for a long time.
So the interface, just one more question.
Yeah, sure.
Because you look around, right? Just two questions about it. What do you think as a developer or educator, and what would be the interface for the future there? Will it be that ring there where you happen to have, you know, just that touch feeling where you can use a ring or a wrist? Or will it be more to focus on what, you know, the AI sees and how we project on models? So my question is essentially, where do we focus? Is it the interface more, or is it the, what do you think, where it's going to go, that way or that way?
Yeah.
Because they're testing a lot of things, right?
It's a great question, and I hope it goes in whatever direction helps connect us more instead of isolating us more. A very valid critique of VR is, you know, if I sat down here right now and put on a VR headset, wouldn't feel like we're having a conversation anymore. Yeah. And I might be looking at some really cool stuff, but like you're now kind of separate from me. Now, mind you, of course, VR also allows us to connect to people who are far away, and that part's great. But so much of what makes life an exciting thing is us being together. You know, we've never gotten to meet in person before. We're here now.
Yeah.
And these interfaces that allow the technology to kind of fall away and you're just having this very natural conversation, experience, whatever, that's where the magic is. So we haven't even talked about the wristband yet. Outside of the, oh my goodness, I'm getting like this full, you know, waveguide field of view that I thought broke the laws of physics, there's that stuff. But the wristband was amazing. I used to have something in 2015 called the Mayo armband. Do you remember what this was?
Yeah, I kind of know.
So the Mayo armband.
Resemblance of it.
Exactly. So the Mayo armband was this little haptic armband that could recognize a few different interfaces that had kind of like, I think like a 3-DOF amount of movement, and it would vibrate too. And it was really cool. Mm-hmm. It wasn't particularly accurate though. Like I did a few little demos with it. I had like a space flight game where you could hit things with a hammer while you're flying. You know, and I was playing with those other kind of modalities of like, how do you mix and match different things that are quite different from what you would do normally with like VR controllers. Thank you. Yeah. Marshall's pulling these things up right now. This is my early Mayo armband dim. And see, flying around hitting stuff. Thank you. Good assistant over here.
Awesome.
We're going to give Marshall a special like credit for, I don't even know what that credit would be. Special, amazing Vanna White person. But yeah, it wasn't accurate enough, so I never felt like I could bring that, especially into the enterprise work I was doing. But this wristband that Meta has now feels like exactly the evolution I wanted from that. It's incredibly accurate, and it means that unlike, you know, everything from a Meta Quest headset to the Apple Vision Pro, hand gestures don't need to be seen by the cameras in your headset.
Right.
You can do this behind your back, and that felt so cool. I could be back there doing like all these different gestures and it's vibrating. Also, by the way, for anyone who's really finicky like me or my children, who kind of wants like a fidget spinner, like something to do with their hands, I would buy this wristband just to be able to enjoy, like even without any application, different vibrations, like different haptic feedback for different gestures. You know, some of the gestures were like the coin flip thing. And even before I put the glasses on, anytime I did a successful gesture, it would vibrate. And there's just like a little dopamine hit to like, I did it. Yeah, cool. And there was something really fun about that. So all of this made it much more natural to interact with the content. But it also made me think that some of the things that are awkward about some modern technology, like speaking out loud to AI, that starts to fall away as well. Because there's all these other ways, like, and you know, I'm not going to do hand gestures out here.
Yeah,
you know? But if I can like have my hands in my pocket and I can be like, you know, sending a message or taking a picture or whatever, and I'm not like, you know, Meta, take a picture now or whatever. It just starts to feel like again, it's allowing for more natural human interaction, and the technology isn't getting in the way. It falls away, and now you're just having the best conversation experience, whatever, that you can possibly have. I mean, the Ray-Ban glasses, even right now, super cool. If you're going on a roller coaster and you now have a very easy way to be like, this is what it's like being on this roller coaster, and that's like very easy to do without pulling up a bunch of equipment and apps. So the more we head in that direction, the more I think we're going to be in a really good place. And I see so much more potential in this glasses direction compared to the VR headset direction, which in some ways feels like a bit of a dead end.
Wow. Wow. I have a prediction, though.
Yes.
I think Apple will come out with something that will kind of be this, kind of what Facebook is doing. I think so. And they will run on the phone, like you're saying. That will be the power of it, right? This will be AirPlay. And they're just figuring out how to stream it without latency and stuff. That's happening in the Apple, what's it called?
Apple Vision Pro.
Apple Vision Pro is like the high end of it. So that's where, if you throw how many thousands of dollars at it?
$3,500, $4,000.
I'd love it, right? But it's just like
out of reach.
Like no. Why? Like, I'd rather buy my 2 GPUs, right?
Yeah, right. Like, get the 5090 as soon as it comes.
Exactly. Out. Like, it's hard to, but maybe no. It has to be that glasses. It has to be glasses. The Apple Watch. That's where Apple has that upper end on. And just, I think it's gonna be that fight with, you know, with the bigger giants trying to figure out, you know.
Yes, I mean, yes. 1,000 times that, Arkash. Like, this is what we've been missing in the VR industry. I was so excited in 2018. Mm-hmm. There was a Google Lenovo headset called the Lenovo Mirage Solo. Do you remember this?
Yes, I remember.
It was a six-DOF headset. First one where you could move around totally standalone without being plugged into a computer.
Yes.
And the controller, though, was a Daydream controller, which was only 3-DOF. It could only detect rotation.
Yes.
I was fortunate to be among a selected group of early developers who was sent a dev kit from Google, which actually was 6-DOF controllers, mm-hmm. and there was a faceplate you put on with like IR and all that so it could read where the controllers were, and that was amazing. It was the first time, it was like, you know, after the Oculus Touch controllers, but again, the first standalone headset where all the stuff worked with inside-out tracking instead of outside-in tracking.
Right.
You know, none of the Constellation cameras and all that. And the thing that got me so excited wasn't just the dev kit itself. It was, oh, this is like, this is Google, like throwing down a challenge and being like, all right, Facebook, what are you going to do now? And so then the Quest 1 came out 6 months later. And I was thinking like, yeah, you know, we're going to have this battle between Google and Facebook, but they're going to keep one-upping each other. But Google, as they do with so many things, they're like, never mind. Like, they just pulled the plug on that and didn't do anything with it.
Just open sourced like all the software.
I mean, it's great when they open source things. I'm glad Tilbrush is open sourced. A lot of the stuff, they just kill it, though. They don't even open source it. Yeah, so that's a bummer. I would have loved an open source 6-DOF standalone headset. That would be amazing. And we're starting to see more of that now. But, you know, it's from a variety of different manufacturers. So I felt like Meta, Facebook, became like a little complacent having the market lead, where like no one was really challenging them. If you compare the number of like Quests sold compared to Pico or Vibe or anything else, like miles, miles ahead. And I think that made them a little bit lazy. They didn't have to innovate a lot. And to be clear, innovation was still happening, and $12 billion a year, you would hope so. But it didn't feel like there were really basic things that my company would be driven crazy by, where it's like basic SDKs that aren't updating. Like we had our first Quest game come out on the store earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And as we're going through the QA process, we moved over to the Meta fork, Oculus fork, of Unreal Engine, and we noticed in their fork of Unreal Engine, lights didn't work.
That's actually possible.
Yeah. So, and apparently we're the first people to notice this. Like, we reached out to some people at Meta, and we're like, yeah, our app was working great. We moved over to your fork to improve frame rate, because then you can turn on things like application space warp. But then all of our movable lights when I say they don't work, they went from working in stereo to only working in one eye.
Okay.
And they're like, oh, yeah, it shouldn't do that. It's like, well, we're supposed to release this app in like a week. So then we had to go through and like create a whole way to do like fake lights with like masked materials and material parameter collections.
Yeah.
So there's just like countless examples of that sort of thing where it's like, come on, Meta. Like, there's so much money here. Like, why can't you do these basic things? But to your point, Apple doing amazing things. Valve Deck.
I think they're sitting on something that's going to be.
Oh, I hope so.
The response to the Quest S.
Yeah.
I think they're sitting on something. Maybe not on the price point. Probably not. my wild guess, because it's gamers, yeah, they'll probably lash out a little bit more for gaming hardware, but it's going to be the Steam Deck of VR.
Maybe. I think you're exactly right. I hope that's true. So there's, for anyone who's like, what are they talking about? There's rumors about something called the Valve Deckard, like from Blade Runner. And there's a lot of hints that something's coming with that, like the refresh of the Steam Deck with the OLED screen was running at 90 FPS, which is a good like frame rate for VR.
This is geek talk.
This is very geek talk. Yeah, if you're still with us, like, thank you for hanging out with our...
Thank you.
We should just change the podcast to like a couple of geeks talking to each other. But I was actually at Valve's office yesterday.
That's why I just mentioned it. I saw it's like...
And let me put a couple rumors to rest, because a lot of people, they saw my post. And by the way, there's an Upload VR article about my experience with the Orion glasses. Very few people got demos, so it was very lucky that myself and my colleague Marshall got these Orion demos. But because of the timing of this, where I got the Orion demo, and then the next day I'm posting all these pictures of like, hey, I'm at Valve's office. All these people assumed that I had gotten to try the Deckard headset. No, I did not. I'm still speculating, just like everyone else. But I have a really good feeling about it. Like, it just feels like this is something that Valve hopefully sees a market opportunity for. I do imagine that at the very least, tell me what you think, that this headset needs to be able to run Half-Life Alyx. Do you think they would release a VR headset that can't run Half-Life Alyx?
No.
Yeah.
No.
So one of two things need to happen, maybe both. They either need to significantly optimize Half-Life Alyx in a way where it can run on more mobile hardware, or they're using Half-Life Alyx in its current form as like the baseline for like, we need the Steam Deck Deckard headset to be powerful enough and have all the right hardware there in order to run.
My prediction is, that's a prediction.
Sure.
I'll shoot. That we'll get a new Steam Deck that will be the heart of that VR headset.
And wouldn't it be cool if, like the Orion glasses, it's wireless and it's like a PC
and it's your actual controller, yeah, because that's also a missing link. With touch controllers, which are good, but not great for gaming, usually.
Yeah, and I think there, people are starting to realize, too, that, like, yes, VR games are great, but there's also something really cool about just being able to have a giant screen,
yes,
that is showing your game. Like, we've got the X-Real glasses, there's the Apple Vision Pro, which lets you have a big, yeah, screen in it. Meta just released HDMI Link, so you can pull up any screen from your phone to your computer into VR. And there's just something very cool and useful about having a giant screen of anything. So even if the Valve Deckard was really more about like playing your 2D Steam Deck games on a giant, yeah, virtual screen, that's something.
Yeah, that could sell. I'm sorry that I'm asking so many questions about VR today, but
we don't get to talk about VR.
I don't get to talk about a lot of people who know this much about VR and is that, you know,
it
really into it. I mean,
for better or for worse.
How much do you, be honest, how much do you actually use VR a week?
Marshall, how much do I use VR a week?
Way more than normal.
I personally do not like the Apple Vision Pro using that thing.
Yeah, Marshall's saying that Marshall's a great foil to me, because often the things that I'm very excited about, Marshall's like, it's not that great. So like, we both have Apple Vision Pros. I'm in mine all the time. Marshall's not really.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
But prior to Vision Pro, how long did you use like a Quest or a Valve? Did you actually use it?
Yeah, but not for fun, really. Like, what I love about the Apple Vision Pros is I use it all the time as a productivity tool. I treat it as a home office with 3D movies playing in the background,
right,
and Discord's here and Slack's here and my MacBook screen is here. And I find it a very comfortable way to work. For Meta Quest headsets and the other developers, that's always felt a little bit more like a gaming console for me. And because most of the VR work AgileLens does is in the enterprise space, you know, I'm using the headsets a lot to test things and make sure we're dog-fooding our own experiences.
Right.
But I haven't spent a lot of time really immersed in VR games. Marshall and I were talking over dinner earlier about, like, you know, Asgard's Wrath, Assassin's Creed, all these kinds of games are amazing and great in VR, but, like, a lot of times we're happy to play it for, like, an hour and be like, okay, I got a sense of it. We don't really feel the need to stay in there beyond feeling like, I get it, I understand this new mechanic or this cool thing they're doing. But we don't have the same kind of completionist tendencies we might have with, you know, playing Hades or something like that.
That's the thing. Like, for me, VR is a work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's a good way to put it.
It's like going out to the proper workout, and that's why.
Props.
Yeah. Fight.
VR things. Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I was just saying that VR is sometimes overwhelming for me. I decided to not just use it, and I've been guilty of it. I mean, I've been in it, out, in, out, in, out, and I've had periods. But seeing your excitement, in general, you're making me trust that it's still worth being in this, developing or something to work on these in this wireless computer.
Yeah,
wireless computers that don't need to be a keyboard and a mouse.
Yeah, which reminds me to go back to what you were saying before about this competition about what Apple might release and all that. Like, that's what's most exciting to me right now about the space is we have proper competition. Like, yes, this has been a very exciting year for Meta's new features. Why? Because they looked at all the things people were excited about the Apple Vision Pro, and they're like, oh, people are talking about how much better the Vision Pro pass-through is than ours. And then Meta made some incredible innovations in how they're taking, and by the way, all the pass-through headsets, incredible, because you have to realize there's cameras not where your eyes are, and they're warping like all these different camera feeds to make you feel like you're seeing through the headset. And understandably, yeah, the Quest 3 cameras, like a lot of distortion, a lot of weirdness. And then everyone's like, oh my goodness, the Apple Vision Pro cameras are a lot better. And Meta's like, well, yeah, they're way more expensive. And they're like, yeah, but they're still better. And then Meta comes and does these amazing things that makes their pass-through way better. And then, you know, this back and forth stuff. Meta now has the HDMI link connection, which is like, it's so easy to do virtual AirPlay, you know, from a MacBook to a headset. So this competition is so good and so healthy. And during this keynote, when Orion's being discussed and they're showing all the amazing things Orion can do, like, absolutely. There was an emergency meeting at Apple the other day where they got into a war room and they're like, how do we fight Meta? And that battle, that competition, I'm sure it's very stressful for everyone at Apple and Google and Meta and all that. But you know who wins? The devs and the consumers and the people who now get to have really excellent devices. And we get to be a little selective, a little choosy. We don't feel like we have to use Meta Quest because that's the most popular device. If there's this real competition, we can be like, well, as a creator, as a developer, like, which device will be the best one for what I'm trying to make? And that puts us in a position of power that we really haven't had in a long time.
Well, I think you're confident, but don't be
okay.
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah.
What I'm alluding also, so we'll kind of bring it back also on a question. What's your take on how Meta is trying, and European Union, and Epic, and Apple?
Yeah.
And they're all kind of in this suit together while trying to push technology to be on our best, you know, interest.
Yeah.
Where are we at? Because I feel like, you know, the European Union won't let, you know, Llama 3.2 in or something, because they're now it does vision recognition.
Right. Yeah.
And it's been trained on European user
UI,
and we didn't give her consent. We have a problem with that.
Yeah.
Well, so how will that work out? And then, well, Epic, you know, is trying to get, well, and it works. I have Epic Store on my phone when I can, you know, access Fortnite, and in the US you can't. Why is this so? Why?
Yeah, I mean,
I ask this question because it just makes our life a lot harder.
Yeah,
you say it's going to make it easier, but they're fighting at the same time and cooperating. It's a bit weird.
Yeah, it's like you want the fighting to be happening on a level playing field. Like the stuff between Epic and Apple, that's a little different, because that's like, you know, Apple has this insane hammer called the App Store that is such a market dominator. Like, there's not really any real competition to that. Like, yeah, the Android store, but not really. And so, yeah, I understood Epic, and Epic's actually a little guy compared to Apple if you just look at their market cap and all that. So the little guy be like, we don't want to pay these 30% fees, and Apple's like, you still have to, crush and destroys them. Yeah, those battles, like, those are rough ones, because that's a monopoly trying to maintain its monopoly versus the headset battle. That's still kind of, it's very easy for us as the consumers to try that out. As consumers, it's hard for us to not use the App Store, you know? And it's also funny though, when Facebook and Meta is like, well, we don't want to be like Apple with all of their like fees and commissions. Like, they also charge 30% fees on their store.
Well,
it's a very similar model. Yeah, still a lot of gatekeeping.
It's different though. They get a bigger cut when you're in their ecosystem.
Well, it helps when you're a private company, you know? Like, I think Unity really went downhill when they became a public company, and now they're much more focused on appeasing shareholders than developers and creators. Epic, I still think, has a lot more care for that. you know, I mean, they're chasing where the money is, which is Fortnite. And I think we see more energy going toward UEFN compared to Unreal Engine right now. But they are generally, I'd say, caring more about us than some of these other large corporations are that are just trying to give everyone a good return on their investment.
Yeah, I can say that from experience, the amount of that Epic shares,
you
know, and there's general is this is the actual vision code.
Yes.
We've been seeing one actually in interacting with really, this is the first one.
Yeah.
With experience.
Yeah. A little protective case on the front to make sure it doesn't shatter.
Yeah, I'll be careful.
Right.
So this is a protective case.
That's a protective case, yeah. Yeah.
You have two of them. No.
We're just bringing out the different devices. Well, like we got so many devices ready to go. Yeah. We've been giving a lot of demos, so yeah. Yeah, that's the little sleepy pillowcase. Wait. Apple Vision Pro has to go to bed.
I just wanted to show this is pretty much made in here, technology here. This is Alex's toys.
And Marshall's.
And Marshall's, right. So you sit in this every day.
Yes, every day. And you can see I'm trying really hard to make these companies play nicely with each other.
All of us would love them. Same here with virtual production.
It's out into the universe. Come on, Epic and Apple. You guys can get along. Yeah, and to your point, also, like, we're going to be hanging out with our friend Michael Becker at Unreal Fest, and he works for Disney, and he's one of these people who, like, loves Unreal Engine, works for Disney, does a lot of stuff with Apple, too, and, like, there's all these people who want to see all these companies get along, but it's just, you know, like, the mommy and daddy are fighting, and the kids are just like, why can't we just all play nice together? So it's just a really tricky, challenging situation.
I can imagine, yeah. But I think they're going to figure it out either one way or the other, where one company will just be like, this is the company that you go to for the headset, this is the company that you go for the AI to, or this particular AI will be good at this thing, while this AI, yeah. I don't know if Epic will even go into and I don't think they mind the AI when I ask them, but they don't share openly like what kind of AI is going on, but that's not just another story. But these, just going back to these headsets, they are a marvel of technology. I wish I brought my old, we could have like all the old ones. I've got the DK1,
yeah.
I've got the DK2, the classic ones, yeah, they're all, yeah, but this is just on another level.
One of the big problems with the Vision Pro, by the way, is there's too much weight on your face, particularly your cheeks. I think Apple was like, we want something that looks pretty. It's actually not very comfortable to wear. This is my favorite head strap. Just going to give a shout out to Anapro. Anapro, this is their version 2 head strap. It takes like all the weight off your face, puts it very gently over your head.
Can I try it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I highly, we'll put a link to where to get this in the comments. But I highly recommend this as a accoutrement to the Vision Pro for added comfort.
Press and hold. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
We're adjusting Bartosz's IPD.
Oh, so it has automatic IPD.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a...
Wow, wait. Whoa.
We're getting a live reaction.
This is my first reaction. Holy moly.
Yeah.
No way. No way.
And then I'll try dialing. What do you see now?
It's okay.
Yeah. Did that do anything?
No, it made it a little bit darker.
Oh, a little bit less?
Okay, now I'm in, I can see my virtual reality.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
I just put him in a virtual environment.
So this works through the...
Yeah, it's like a reality knob.
Reality knob, so I can go... Oh, you can do this in Unreal, I think. You showed that in the demo, right? That's really cool. So you can go into... Wait, that's so cool. That's really Apple like. I can say that.
Yeah.
Okay, so your primary use for this, you sit in the office, right?
Yeah.
What do you do? You put
screens.
I like the video. I'll just see the video. I'm not going to go into the interface or anything.
Yeah.
Because I just feel that this is really blowing my mind.
Yeah.
Because I, to be honest, I tried to do this. I tried to do this on the Quest 1. I tried to do it on DK 2 to just have a continuous video feed.
Yeah,
with stereo.
Mm-hmm.
unachievable in my workshop. It's just, it would be either laggy or it was just like, so seeing this,
that was hard.
I want to go back to reality.
Yeah, yeah. It's insane. It is pretty trippy. No screen door effect there.
All right, that makes sense now why it costs that much.
For sure. I mean, yeah.
Now it makes sense. Now
it's all glass and metal. And
now it
expensive.
Actually makes sense. No, but it just...
I'm sorry that I'm kind of... Because I'm like getting excited by something that you've been using for how long?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's...
How long have you been...
Since it came out in February.
Right.
And I started developing for the simulator.
So can you just share anything for in regards for developing for this?
Mm-hmm.
That, like anything, like,
yeah.
What's the consumer? What is he looking for an app here?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we do apps for the watch that talk to this?
Yeah.
Do we experiment with?
I've been trying really.
Can
hard.
You can you attach something here and make it come here?
That's yeah. So right now there's not a lot of interface between different Apple devices.
I see.
You can do casting. You can do AirPlay between your phone, your computer. All that stuff can come up in the Vision Pro, which is great. I've been trying for a while to make this vibrate when I do a haptic gesture, just like the armband that was revealed.
So they would talk to each other.
It's hard. It's difficult to like get that to work. I'm trying to do stuff with HTTPS and all that.
Right.
But going back to your earlier question, like, what do I do with this? I'm often sitting in it while casting the screen. It's great on plane flights, too. Like, when you're in a tight space, this does such a good job of opening everything up and just making you feel like you're in a much better environment.
Yeah.
And I also like the fact that it kind of forces me to focus. I'm kind of a captive audience, too, whether I'm watching a 3D movie. By the way, best way to see 3D movies. I never cared about seeing 3D movies in theaters. Now I love them. And I'm like actively seeking out any movie that has a 3D version to watch it. But then having, you know, a big version of my screen and all these other things pulled up. And, you know, sometimes I'll have like Cut the Rope or some like silly little mobile game off to the side because they've just let all these mobile games into here as well, which is why I also think Meta has decided to open their app store. Again, there's all this call and response stuff between these different companies. But I especially thanks to the strap, I now find it to be a very comfortable headset. And I get a lot of work done in there.
Wow. So this pass-through doesn't compare to this one.
You know what? But that's it. It's gotten way better. It's closer now. It's closer, not as good. But how could it be when...
This is way lighter.
Way lighter, yep. Well, part of that's the materials.
Right.
Apple wants things to look and feel expensive. So they're using real glass and like, you know...
Got it. Yeah.
Heavy metals.
Yeah. Yeah. Premium.
Everything. So a lot there. And it looks beautiful and it feels like a real artifact, but it's not as comfortable to wear for 4 hours. You know?
I'm just wondering still, like, where is the use case for it? Like, besides watching a 3D movie, besides...
I'll give you a simple one. Architectural walkthroughs, especially of a construction site. If you want to see pass-through and you want to say, okay, you know, like, I'm at the actual location where this is going to be built. And I see, okay, this column's going to go up here. And you're like, wait, where's the HVAC going to be? And you see a visualization of that.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, wait, there's going to be a conflict because that column is going right into where that HVAC duct needs to be. That's incredibly useful to do on site. Not as useful, like if you're in VR, you can do a virtual walkthrough. But especially if you see on site conditions and you're like, oh, there's actually a tree there, you know, like you see the actual thing in the real world and you're overlaying that digital information on top of the real world. That's a tremendously useful.
It is. But when I talk to like professionals in the industry about this and like, hey, you can do this on the Quest, and same kind of story.
Yeah.
They're like, well, this is a 15-year-old technology. Right. We've been always using it. Why are you excited about it?
Yeah.
Like, here's a company that's been, you know, doing this for 15 plus years. We put a QR code. Here's your piping. Everybody knows where to bring the bricks.
Yeah.
And they're like, and when I talk to their reps and they're like, we like the VR, AR, Unreal Engine, everything, because it gives us a fresh wave to our industry that's really boring. That's what I've learned.
Yeah.
But it's always been there. And we're excited about technology that's kind of been there. Just not really to the consumer.
So it's interesting in that sense.
But that's a really good case.
Yeah. And to answer your earlier question as well about how does someone even get started developing for this, in Unreal Engine, it's free, which is nice. Unity charges you a special license. But you can basically open up the Vision Pro Templars, the Vision Pro Templars. That's my special GitHub for like my secret club. My secret club gets some cool things. But there is the VR template, the same one that I've been using for years. If you open that up on a MacBook, Silicon MacBook, M1, M2, M3, and you build from there, it'll create a .app file, which you can put onto a Vision Pro headset. You can also create the Xcode file, open that up, do some modifications, do things with Swift, and it actually integrates really well into the Apple ecosystem. And now with VisionOS 2.0, now we can activate pass-through, you can do virtual reality, mixed reality, you can have certain elements that are pass-through, and it's becoming a very dynamic way to use Unreal Engine, even without any support from Apple, which is kind of cool.
Wow. So have you experimented with any camera tracking as being this as a camera tracker?
What for what use case?
For being like, let's say, I'll give you an example. I think this was an app developed by the Shopify team, and they released it, Tracky. And basically it's you can add the tracking points while you're shooting, right? While you're going at it. And that will give me back the video plus these points, and I can pop in a 3D model.
Yeah.
How hard is to do something like this on this?
Yeah, great question. So first of all, one of the things that's most impressive about the Vision Pro is the tracking is rock solid. Like when you place a window or an object somewhere in space, I could put a 3D model in the middle of this table, walk around this whole lobby, come back, and that 3D model would still be there. If I did that on the Quest or my phone, it's probably going to drift. It's going to feel a little bit jagged. Rock solid there.
Yeah.
In Unreal Engine right now, we don't have scene understanding, the ability to understand, like, this is a plane, let's do plane detection, or recognize furniture, any kind of object recognition. You can do a lot of those things through...
Do the pass-through, right? We can't access the pass-through.
Well, you can. To be clear, using Apple's tools, if you were in Apple's ecosystem of using Reality Kit and Reality Composer and all that, you can access a lot of these things. Unreal Engine right now, though, even though it recognizes pass-through, it can't do things with that pass-through information. It can't be like, oh, let's snap this 3D model to this table because we know this is a table. Oh, yeah. Unreal Engine can't see that right now.
It can only be done through some kind of plugins, right?
Stuff. Or you do it manually. Like, you know, you place the 3D model on the table and it'll stay there perfectly, but it's you doing that manually, not automatically.
Right. Okay, interesting. Yeah, the pass-through thing is Unreal. It's tricky. I've played around a little bit with developing an AR app, trying to get it work, and it's just like, I don't want to say about Apple, but oh my God, like one of the main things that people don't get into app development is because they can't get through the performance certificates to just get.
Here with the VR headset, you can run that.
We have an interruption to the podcast. This is Samuel Bass.
Hi, I'm Samuel.
Oh, great. Nice to meet you.
Sir, are you podcasting right
now? No, it's fine.
We were just going at it.
Yeah, Sam, very quickly, tell everyone what you do for Epic Games.
I'm Sam. I'm a tech designer at Epic Games, and I probably shouldn't be on camera.
If he says anything more, he might get fired.
Okay. That's fine. Yes. So we'll just put the camera here.
Bye-bye. See you soon. Yeah.
That was a cool introduction.
Now that Sam's gone, I can say he's a wonderful member of Epic Games who also really helps out with things like mega grants. To be fair, I've never actually gotten a mega grant, but he gives really good feedback on like decks.
Would you apply for one?
Huh?
Would you apply for one?
Would I apply for one? I've applied for several. I've been unsuccessful with them all.
Really? But I applied for one.
Yeah.
And it's unsuccessful. I want to try again. Why were they unsuccessful? Why do you think? Is it just because the timing idea, or is it just a combination of everything?
Yeah, I mean, this could be a downer of a discussion because the Mega Grants program is sad to me because you get so excited. You're like, oh, could I get money to build this really cool idea in Unreal Engine? But you don't really get feedback. It's just like rejected. Yeah, you know, some people will get feedback. We've done 4 Mega Grant submissions, never gotten any feedback. I did hear through the grapevine, through some contacts at Epic, that the first time I submitted, which was for a startup I had called Heaven U, was cloud computing, pixel streaming, live events, that the feedback I got was like, oh, well, they thought it was too much like CineTracer by Matt Workman. And I'm like, that's a completely different application. So it's like a part of me was like, am I doing a very bad job of explaining this? Or are some of the people looking at the mega grants just not looking very closely at them?
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and I applied for one for this podcast too, for the Unreal podcast. Yeah. So
Ah, interesting, interesting. I heard that a lot about the mega grants that they look at is not the idea itself that much. It's rather who's applying and what their track history and everything is and what they can bring to the table.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned.
That makes me more sad. I was like, I want to believe that all my friends at Epic think of me and my company as a very reliable company that makes a lot of really cool stuff in Unreal Engine. But if they're like, oh, no, like we don't want to give any money to this loser, that'd be kind of sad. No.
It's not that. It's just that I think they get a lot of applications from all around the world.
And it's free money. Like, you can't really complain about not getting free money.
Did you apply for a lot?
I've done all these different tiers. Like,
you tried the tiers.
I tried asking for $20,000, $50,000, $200,000. I think one I was like $5,000. And still,
went through.
Yeah. Okay. And I did get told like some mistakes I made, like applying for hardware, cloud costs, things like that.
That's also a hurt. No-go zone hardware.
Yeah, I was told like you really want to be saying like I need to hire Unreal developers and it's going to take this much time. For the podcast, I was just like, I'd like to give our guests a little money and stuff like that. And you know, get more equipment to film and that kind of thing. Just no success and no real feedback officially on why. So it's okay.
I think the only tip that I could give myself and you maybe for this is to focus on how the idea of a mega grant that you're trying to apply will get people more using Unreal Engine and not being afraid of it.
Exactly.
Because there's a lot of stigma about learning something new, jumping into it. So that's the main focus, I think, around it. What kind of industry can it bring in more?
Absolutely. Yeah. And they do seem to require, as part of the application process, there's a question like, how will this grow the Unreal community?
Yeah.
You know, so try to do the best to be like, one of the things we applied for was also this kind of theater making platform that was going to be like kind of a Twinmotion-esque wrapper around Unreal Engine to make it very easy for anyone to build a live theater show from scratch. Mm-hmm. And again, like, you know, we think it's a really good idea. We think it's going to grow the Unreal Engine community. We just asked for money for developers and still just like rejected. And it's like, oh, but tell me why.
Yeah. There's no explanation, right? Yeah. Because it makes sense. Well, it's not fair, I guess, because it would be nice to get some feedback. I agree.
Like you said, there's so many applications.
But in the business, I guess it's more of a business relationship where, well, we're interested or not, right? But it's like venture capital, they would be interested or not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm never going to complain about Epic Games. Like, you and I are both here.
Yeah.
Like, Epic pays for our travel, our hotel. Like, we're very grateful.
We're super grateful for this. And if it wasn't for Epic, I wouldn't be at this place where I am. And just being,
literally
for the instructor badge, that changed a lot how my career developed, actually, as an educator. Completely changed how I'm approached by either my clients, my professional connections also. It's been completely different. It's been from funny things that people message me from Dubai, like thinking me that I'm Epic.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah.
That's funny.
Can you get me V-Bucks? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Or yeah, or do you want, like, or they say, like, can you get, like, Epic to join us event? I think you should, like, contact them.
Right.
But it's funny because they think that we're really them.
Yeah, right.
Because we're so open about it. Mm-hmm. And
we evangelize it. We're like, here's all the reasons people should use Unreal Engine. So it's like, well, they must be paying you to say that.
they used to tell me that also. When I went to the studios and was teaching about Unreal Engine, they would tell me, Bart, you're wasting your time with us here. And I'm like, why? You should go work at Epic. And like, it didn't make any sense. I was like, you know, with my just desktop PC, bringing it under my, you know, belt, putting it on the studio floor, and just saying, hey guys, this is Unreal Engine.
Yeah.
And they would just like be all over it. So that was just crazy, that part.
Yeah. I hear you. Well, we've been going for a long time.
I think this is a really long one.
It's a great one, though. It's good, and we should absolutely promote some of the things going on here at Unreal Fest in case we get this episode out soon.
Yeah.
So, funnily enough, I wasn't looking. So the live labs went live very, very late. Like the idea for these learning labs with about 30 people per lab, usually the signups for that would go out pretty soon. Epic this year was like, well, we want to make sure that everyone who gets a ticket has an equal chance of getting in these learning labs. So we're not going to open up registration until Unreal Fest sells out. And right away when they said that, I was like, oh, it's like Unreal Fest is more expensive this year. There's a much larger crowd. I was like, I don't know if it's going to sell out. And from what I'm hearing, it's like very close to selling out. But they just made the learning labs go live the other day.
Right.
And it was when the meta keynote started.
Right.
So I was like, trying to do things at once. But yeah, all of our learning labs went up quickly. They sold out in like 5 minutes.
They're
like,
already gone, right?
Really, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's go over what we're teaching. And
okay.
I was going to say, I signed up for Bartosz's MetaHuman animation one.
I wanted to sign up for yours, but my app crashed. Yeah. I couldn't get an email registration to come, and I couldn't log in.
Yeah. Oh, and before I forget, let me be very clear about this. If anyone out there is like, I really wanted to go to Bartosz's class or Alex's class or Corey
Strasburger's
class.
I want to go really that. I wish I could go back.
Yeah, I did get into that one. I'm very excited. The thing you can do, any of these live labs you want to go to, just show up 10, 15 minutes early. There's a waiting line. There are so many things going on at Unreal Fest at any given moment. There's 17 talks, and there's people just chatting in hallways, and there's the expo floor. Very, very good chance if you show up 15 minutes before a lab starts, you will make it in. You know, anyone who officially signed up will get in, but then they let in everyone in the waitlist line, and you're going to be fine.
Right. So what are you teaching?
This is nice, too, because, like, you know, when I'm giving, I'm going to back up for a second to, like, philosophize on when I'm giving a class or a talk that's going to be recorded, I sweat over it. Like, I am up all night the night before. I'm rehearsing. I'm getting all my slides right.
Yeah.
I'm very focused because I know this is going to go up on YouTube and I want it to be useful. Like, right. My worst fear is people on YouTube, right? Like, the internet, people on the internet saying, like, what a waste of my time. Like, I just watched this hour-long thing and I didn't learn anything. Like, that's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah.
So I don't mind with the live labs so much sweating over it. I'm much more relaxed about it because it's a little more organic. You're chatting with everyone. And so I'm not too stressed out about the three labs I'm going to be a part of. The one I'm leading is the intro to variant manager and configurator templates. Really cool ways to do like design options and swapping things in Unreal Engine that not a lot of people know about.
Yeah.
Then Yu Junya from my company, she will be leading a lab on intro to augmented reality based on a course that we made together for Epic Games. And it will touch on like Apple Vision Pro development, but it'll also be about using the handheld AR template. That'll be a good one. And then the third one is with Whit Sellers, who I mentioned earlier, and that'll be called Mind the Gap, transitioning from Unity 3D to Unreal. And we're going to be trying to make it very easy for anyone who has more familiarity with Unity to make that journey over to the Unreal Engine side. And each of those is an hour long, and I think it's going to be a really good flyby of some cool stuff. What about you, my friend?
I want to go to your class about the Apple Vision Pro development. That sounds super exciting.
Right. So, and by the way, I tried to get Epic to... let me create an Apple Vision Pro course for them. They're like, no. So I've been developing one separately, and I've got my own little Discord and like my group of Apple Vision Pro developers. But outside of Unreal Fest, on October 10th at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I will actually be teaching a dedicated Apple Vision Pro for Unreal Engine course over Zoom. Anyone can join it. The first one will be free. Then they'll cost something as we go on.
Right.
And anyone who wants to join that can go to alexcoulombpresents.com to sign up for the newsletter and get information about learning to build for Apple Vision Pro. You can also use the simulator if you don't have an actual device.
Wow. That sounds super cool that you're digging into this, really. And you're one of the first in the world, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, really, there's not many people openly talking about this and sharing the development story.
There's dozens of us. Dozens.
No, there's not. I think there's only a few people in the world that actually openly share it and are on the map. It's really hard to find. Or you sometimes might find some obscure person that has 15 subs on YouTube and has amazing content that nobody knows and it doesn't share it to nobody, and you find out and you watch all of their content.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to be teaching about metahumans, mm-hmm. mainly, focusing on two things. One is Unreal Engine 5, and using metahumans with the new game animation sample project, which is amazing. Really cool. It's amazing, and it makes my life as an animator, gameplay enthusiast, hacker so much more fun than the basic third-person template that we've been stuck for years. And it's just so, you know, it's
dynamic.
It's so dynamic, okay. Right? So that's one class. And the second class is all about using the same kind of knowledge, but in UEFN. Rather than building it up in Unreal from scratch, we're going to use all the great components that UEFN offers and build out our simple experience trying to build a 2v2 racing game where a metahuman does a 15-second intro using a mocap suit that will be played back on stage by yours truly and a mocap professional who will be also helping out me on stage. Hopefully, we might be able to get two mocap suits running at the same time.
Yeah.
Two different ones.
Wow. With all the wireless interference, that'll be impressive.
I have my own router.
Yeah. Okay, good, good.
That's dedicated for it, and hopefully we'll be able to put it off as a demo that, hey, Unreal Engine can receive signals from any kind of hardware. If it's a VR headset, if it's your phone or a mocap suit, it will all go through some kind of live link system and be captured there sooner or later.
That's great. Quick question about the first course. In the game animation sample, to get a metahuman in there, are you using the live retarget setup there, or how are you getting the metahuman into there?
The live retarget setup, yes.
It's really simple.
It's very simple. Yeah. It's quick. It's easy to use. You just duplicate what's there. Yeah. You add your own metahuman there, and you can start playing with your own metahuman already in a really, really powerful project. Yeah. I don't think a lot of people truly know how powerful that kind of template is already there, and how much it will grow with the marketplace and Fab coming soon. You know, that will be just, you'll be just drag and dropping. Hey, I want sliding. Hey, I want climbing now. It will be just a paid add-on by a developer who's already on the marketplace, and it will just slot into this great animation system, and you're off making, you know, amazing games already at this level. And I can just say that working and seeing how game development has been evolving over these years, having these kind of available for free projects for you to play with is just something that I think only Unreal Engine offers. That's why I'm here. I'm sticking with this, and I'm going to be teaching it as much as I can.
Amen to that. And of course, anyone who is going to be here for Unreal Fest, like, go to Bartosz's classes. They're going to be amazing. For anyone who's sad that they aren't going to be here, to get a little morsel of some of what we're talking about, I don't think I've ever mentioned on the podcast that my other Unreal Fest Prague talk, Diving Deep with Metahumans, is on Epic Games' YouTube channel. And at the very end...
Check it out.
Yeah. And at the very end of it, I do actually go over some of the live retargeting that we're discussing here. So, yeah, use that with the game animation sample. And we're gonna see if we can find a way to record some of our lab session content. So maybe you'll see some of that online. Hopefully,
I'm gonna do my best because I think it's exciting. I think also teaching live is a little bit different than studio.
Oh yes,
and I like that we have the option to record our talks, our labs in the studio environment, but we get this experience live.
Yeah.
So we can bring that into that studio. Kind of pre-recorded, pre-set up everything, but the live element will be here.
Yeah.
We'll live through it, right?
Exactly. I was going to say, perfect timing. They're like turning the lights off and like fading down on the episode.
So thank you so much, Alex. This has been amazing.
Yeah. Bartosz, where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
LinkedIn, just Bartosz Barlowski, barlowski.com.
We'll show notes.
Check it out. I post all my videos there, and I try to keep it as much as I can updated. So
yeah, well, the way we started to end the episode, every episode of season 3 so far, is we like to try to do a high five. Now, of course, that's usually very difficult because we're in our Light Twist virtual studio and trying to make cameras work. It's going to be a little bit easier here, but I'm going to make it a little bit more interesting by having us both put on a headset and try to do a high five while we've got these headsets.
All right, okay.
Let's see how well it goes.
Let's see. This will be a first.
All right,
I need to go. Will I get past through? All right. Okay, I'm on.
Let me know when you're ready.
I'm ready.
We're going to try to do a high five. 3, 2, 1. Oh, almost. One more time. 3, 2, 1. Hey! End of episode.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Thank you.